So, my best friend tells me that my two main flaws are that I'm self-absorbed and place too much importance on art. And so the first one explains, I guess, a bit what I'm going to talk about. And the second explains why I'm here. And I am a neuroscientist, and I could talk to you very authoritatively about electrophysiological properties of neurons in the lateral hypothalamus with regards to glucose sensing and metabolism and the new technology developed to activate neurons with magnetic radiation and radio waves and looking at behaviour. And that's what I do.
Can you speak up a little?
Sure, and that's what I do. But I think what Alex knows that I'm also interested in is communicating aspects of science that might interest artists. And that is, there's no real space for it to be known. So you're also going to see me in crisis a little bit, talking about some of the things I experience every day. And this isn't like a formal talk. This, you know, I'm not presenting my data, or the point of it is not to communicate, you know, findings, but more to give you a large array of things that I know that I've come across that I think would be of interest to you. So I don't know if any of you have read Mind in Life by Evan Thompson. Has anyone read that here? Okay, good. Because basically, if you had, then you could maybe just sort of take a snooze or something, because I was thinking about things and how to look at life and what, you know, the sort of phenomena I was observing and the way I view the world. And I wrote an essay about it, and then I realised, oh, Evan Thompson wrote a whole book about it, and he's a philosopher. So I kind of came to this idea completely separately. And I'm going to end with an animal model of despair. And I kind of want to say that art, like, has really, really helped me in moments of despair, and I really... I'm happy to be here to give something back to the community and the little people whose work means a lot to me and who mean a lot to me. So we have no sound, but if you know the film well, this is the scene from Manhattan where they're in the planetarium and they're debating about rational thought. And Max is saying, you know, that anything that is worth knowing can't be known by the mind. And then he ends sort of pithily with saying that the brain is the most overrated organ. And I'm a neuroscientist, but I'm also deeply sceptical of anything that becomes really popular. And so the brain's become kind of popular and a bit, you know, I feel like an adolescent who's band suddenly everybody likes and, you know, makes me not like it. So this talk is actually going to be about how, hey, okay, the brain is pretty cool, but there's a lot of other stuff going on, and we shouldn't be so neurocentric about the way that we view ourselves, I think. So a lot of the time I think I'm insane, and then someone I really admire says something that I kind of think all the time. And so this is actually a quote by David Cronenberg, and I think about this a lot, and I imagine this a lot, and if I go into the countryside, I kind of forget I'm a human being sometimes, because there's nothing really there letting me know that I am. And so the fact is, we are all one cell. We were all once one cell, evolutionary speaking, as bacteria, or as, you know, sperm and egg fused. And even at this level, the cell has to keep track of what's going on, you know, osmotic pressure, mechanopressure, energy. This is just biology, you know, high school biology now, but I just like the idea of like a ghost, a cell ghost. But you know, if you put things in different concentrations, then the cell is either going to like shrink or expand because of this, and these are extreme cases, but all the time there's this negotiation of having to maintain a stable state. And that's at the cellular level, but the same concepts then get applied, you know, to the whole organism, whereby at the cell it might just be an opening and closing of an ion channel, but these mechanisms then get translated into loops which are involve, you know, hormones travelling across huge distances to act on receptors to basically do the same thing for the organism. And the behaviour of cells on when they're on their own change, you know, when they become many. And, you know, I think artists are interested now in this phenomenon, quorum sensing, whereby bacteria change their behaviour because they can sense changes in concentration gradients. That gives them an idea about the size of the colony, and then they change their behaviour in order to make the most of the metabolic fuel like of available to them. And so there's this kind of tension then between staying stable but then also having to change. And change is good. You know, there are antibiotics, and bacteria mutate and divide, and the mutations that occur enable them to keep the colony going. I don't know, I had a conversation with an artist whereby I always thought evolution was kind of like these happy accidents that happen, whereas he had this concept of this, like, it was more of like a force, you know, like maybe the bacteria like going, yeah, we're going to beat the antibiotics, we're going to mutate, whereas I was a bit like, whoops, oh, that worked out, like, whoops. So I don't know how you like to think about these things. And so from one cell we develop into a whole organism, and how really does that happen? I mean, it's like mind-boggling to think about, right? This is happening. This isn't working. Oh, this is a shame. Because this video is really cool. Can we change? Can I put this in here? If not. Yeah. Or should I keep going and then play those videos at the end if people want to see them?
It might be less disruptive.
Okay, cool. So basically, this is a really pretty video right now, and the cells like dividing rapidly. And then this is. That was a zebrafish embryo, and this is a Drosophila larvae, and we have a really amazing technology now whereby I think we should change because the mice stuff is going to be... Yeah, thanks. Okay. Okay. I mean, just because I'm assuming a lot of you are visual people, I really appreciate some of the aesthetic qualities of science, and it really makes me sad when a lot of the presentations we have are pretty ugly. And so this is really cool. So when the cell is dividing, each cell is taking cues, chemical cues, And again, the thing that sets it all off is an asymmetry, right? So there's this, again, this tension between wanting to be stable, but it's the instability that, like, sets this whole process off. And cells somehow can detect cues about, like, where to go, and then to divide and to differentiate and what to become. And so I really like the idea of each cell being a record of where it of time. So where it is in space and the identity, you know, what it's become is a record of time, as if you were, like, going to, like, cut open the tree and, like, count the rings or something. Let's explore this. So. And then again, I think once everything's got there, everything once in place, everything's being replaced all the time. These tissues are being maintained, and if they get damaged, then there's little messengers saying, "Hey, I'm damaged. Come fix me." And I just think we're not thinking about these things. You know, you don't need an fMRI machine to measure the healing of bone, but that I think must be intelligence in some form. And here's another Cronenberg quote, I think these things are just doing their own thing. They're not, like, out to get us, but they want to survive.
Becomes polarized.
Oops. So we have these ways of fighting against disease. So it's this battle again. Like, these pathogens are adapting all the time to elude us, and we're trying to keep up with them. But what we've learned over the whole course of evolution is about, like, what is foreign, like, what is dangerous, what is something that's not that. And these are encoded in the germline in these recognition pattern receptors. And this is the innate immune system, and then the innate immune system gets triggered and activates the adaptive immune system. And the way that the cells of the adaptive immune system produce these antibodies, and the cells mutate rapidly, like over a million times more mutations per second than regular cell division. And the antibodies have different receptor subunits, and so they form all these different combinations. And so each combination fits the foreign antigen better and better and better, and becomes selective. It's like natural selection again on this, like, tiny, tiny micro scale. And so that means that when we get infected again, we can respond, and that's a form of memory, right? You know, I always think of memory, hippocampus, you know, but this is a form of memory, which is something I think people often associate with the brain. And so over the course of, like, evolution, we've learned to recognize what is not us and what is us. But then the immune system is also amazing because it can attack a tumor cell, right? So a tumor cell is still us, but it's us that's getting out of control. So what it's not detecting something foreign, it's just noticing something else. And then also it can go wrong. I mean, it's told us what we are, but sometimes we start to attack ourselves. And I think it's kind of trendy now, but you know, a lot of mental health conditions are now being they're being treated like autoimmune disease. Like, I was doing research for this, and, like, even Tourette's. I mean, I would never even thought of Tourette's as, like, an autoimmune disease, but there's a lot of evidence for that. And so, because immune cells learn and remember, and so do neurons, it's tempting to make analogies between them, and this has been recognized more and more, and now computational algorithms exist that mimic the immune system, artificial immune systems, and they're being used to, you know, protect computers from viruses. I think it's really interesting. I also think it's interesting, and that we're still so brain focused that whenever we encounter some form of intelligence or cognition, decision making anywhere else, it's like, oh, it's like the brain. Whereas, you know, it's intelligence, it exists all over in its own distributed functionality. So the immune system and the nervous system talk to each other all the time. There are immune cells in the brain. These are called microglia. When I was an undergrad, no one cared about glia at all. You know, it was called glue. Like, no one was like, we don't know what it does, so it obviously does nothing. You know, it's and now everyone is crazy about glia. And neurons innervate all the tissues in the periphery that have immune cells. And so immune cells express all the receptors for neurotransmitters, and neurons can be activated and inhibited by cytokines, which are the chemicals released by the by immune cells. And so again, I think it's like an accident of history that we've attributed such chemicals to such systems. It's almost like this order of discovery has created this narrow labeling, which is now how we've come to view ourselves, and I think it's warped. And it's become more obvious how much these two systems, again, you know, are my worst enemy. I'm even saying it, talk to each other, because things go wrong, and we're now realizing more and more how interconnected this whole thing is. So a lot of research is going on now around inflammation and this HPA axis. Do you guys know what that is? I don't know. If you don't. It's like, it's basically the stress response. It's like when it's the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland, the adrenal gland. So if you're, it's like chronic stress, you're going to have immunological problems, then that's going to act on the brain, then you're going to have cognitive, like, and mood problems. All these things are acting together at the same time, and I just think of, kind of view it as this like tension between all of them. You know, not one is more important than the other necessarily. Another thing that I think is really interesting now, and you've probably heard a lot about the microbiome because it's become really trendy. So, okay, you've got your immune system and it's going, oh, not me, kill it. But then actually when the enteric nervous system is the nervous system that innervates the gut. And there are actually as many neurons in the gut as in the spinal cord, like if not more, and those neurons produce like all the neurotransmitters that you know that the brain does. And I think what's really interesting is that when you're growing from embryo, like pre-embryonic stage, okay, these neural crest cells which become the nerves that innervate the gut, they rely on these factors that are produced, you know, within the embryo. But actually, to have a properly innervated digestive system, you need it's the contamination of the amniotic fluid with bacteria in it that creates an immune response that then signals the rest of the development. So I think it's really interesting. There's the stuff that's not you that is bad, but then you have to also recognize the stuff that's not you, that actually kind of like is you, you know, and is going to help you. And so I think that's kind of really interesting. So, yeah, as I was saying, gut talks to brain, vice versa, and the bacteria talks to the gut, talks to the brain, and so the bacteria talks to the gut, the neurons in the gut talk to the brain, but then there's also this like immune response, which then talks to the neurons, you know, and this is all just happening, you know, at the same time. And, you know, many mood disorders now are being attributed to, you know, poor microbiome or autoimmune dysfunction. You know, it's kind of interesting. And so I think what I think about is like, you know, it's taken for all these things to go wrong for you to notice it, but this is stuff is happening all the time, this kind of communication or this existence. So because of fear's interest, this is something I've kind of wanted to talk about or make fun of, or I don't know, it's a very strange thing. My friend I guess I just know a lot of stuff that I know and I forget other people don't know, and I just assumed everyone knew that, okay, before you're going to take a drug, this drug has been tested on animals, and, you know, aside from the ethical issues, like, it's really hard to maybe measure, like, a depressed mouse, you know? Like, how do you do that? And this is exactly why I'm in the lab I'm in. Like, my boss, Jeffrey Friedman, living legend, cloned leptin. And you knock leptin out of a mouse, and it's huge. There's no getting away from it. You give it leptin, it shrinks. I'm looking at the brains of these mice and what was wrong in them. And that's why I chose this lab. It's a phenotype. Do you understand the word phenotype? I wanted to put it in the thing, Alex didn't. So phenotype is basically the manifestation of a genetic state. So that things can differ genetically, but the phenotype is like how this like becomes apparent, like in behavior or just morphology or whatever. So, you know, a leptin knockout mouse has a phenotype of being really huge. And animal behavioral models can be amazing, don't get me wrong. I mean, I think science is like my mum. You know, I love science, and I'm allowed to say bad things about it, but, you know, no one else is. So this is a mouse. This is a mouse with Alzheimer's, basically, and we know a lot about the physiology of Alzheimer's and these plaques that form. And this is a behavioural test that was developed by my mentor in my undergrad in Edinburgh. I didn't realise what a big deal it was. I mean, we just thought it was this thing, and then it was like the Morris Water Maze, and it's like a universal, global standard of you know, how to measure spatial memory in mice. And you can see, because mice don't like swimming, right? And there's this platform, and it's hidden, and it can't see where it is, but it actually has very good spatial memory, so it looks for these visual cues, and it wants to get off the platform. Okay, so you knock out the gene that it is, like, overproducing these plaques, and this guy is like, I'm not having any of this. The platform's around here somewhere, I remember. Yeah, okay, got it. You know, and this is quite a blatant difference. And so behavioural models can be very, very powerful. However, I think when it comes to the different confusing... I mean, it's even hard to diagnose a human, right? You've got this DSM... this seems all very American to me, but you've got this DSM. You've got a self-reporting person who can speak. How on earth are you going to create these models in animals? But then we need something to test the drugs on. So, okay, here's some OCD mice, right? So there are kind of like three main, I would say, approaches of how you can probe this, right? So you can genetically knock out all the genes, overexpressed genes that you've found to be associated with certain conditions, usually from twin studies or these linkage studies. And then you play around with the genes in mice and see if it comes up with anything. Or, I don't know if you know about optogenetics, there's been a lot about it recently. It's this way to selectively stimulate or inhibit populations of neurons. So you do that with a laser, and then you can see the animal behaving in real time. What my lab has just developed, it's coming out in Nature, it's a pretty big deal, is like the first like non-invasive technique in that we overexpress this ferritin construct, which is in all of us right now. It's iron, right? It's iron like that's in hemoglobin. You put that iron in a magnetic field, the iron like is vibrating, this causes a slight change in temperature, and then we also overexpress this heat sensitive channel, which opens. So I mean, come talk to me about anything. That's kind of my expertise. It's just another tool. And this is how we probe this. So there's this task called marble burying, and so OCD mice like really like to bury marbles. So this is what you look at, and this is like how do you quantify it? And so it's just a form of repetitive behaviour. This can also come across as you get mice that scratch their faces till their faces are bleeding. You get it's, you know, grooming, you get mice that just kind of go around in circles. And this is another repetitive behaviour. I just think this guy looks pretty smart. I mean, he's like, get me out of here. You know, it's just like... these go on. So there are lots of different assays. So something that I was kind of really upset about when I found out about it, but a way of modelling depression, well, some of the social aspects involved in maybe autism is that you get, this is just an assay for aggression, actually, so there are people studying aggression, but how you make a depressed mouse is you... house it with a male with a female for like 3 weeks. They kind of get to know each other, you know, they like each other, it's fine. Take the female out, put in a slightly tinier male. The male, the resident male that's been there, will beat the crap out of the tiny mouse. And then this tiny mouse is like our model of depression, okay? So, and so... The way you kind of measure that is then there's this object preference test, right? So the beaten up mouse, again, which is great, so we can collect the serum, da da da. Beaten up mouse has higher cytokines, you know, it has this huge inflammatory response. So going back to it, this is how I've told you everything that I've just told you. So there's this object preference test. So usually, like, mice really like each other, they kind of check each other out, we measure where they're sniffing each other, whatever. A depressed mouse isn't, like, not into other mice. It's, like, prefers objects. I sometimes worry maybe I'm one of these mice. It's like, hey, I think objects are kind of nicer than humans a lot of the time. I'd rather be hanging out with them. But it's kind of interesting. And another one is chronic restraint. Again, this one here. So these guys are alive. They just can't move. And then they become super stressed, you know, and they become very depressed and all mediated through... the immune system, really. So that's kind of interesting. And there are lots of other tests. I mean, especially something that maybe is just too murky to get into, but there's a lot of sex difference behaviour where you can, like, now there are experiments where you can selectively activate neurons and basically make a male adopt maternal behaviour, or make a female, like, kill her pups. You know, it's kind of lots of stuff. So whatever you're interested in, like, let me know. So I kind of think of ourselves of, like, so on the inside, like, there's this immune system, you know, negotiating what isn't us. And then I feel like on the outside, we're also, like, negotiating what isn't us. And... now, both the body, how we see our bodies, and how we see the world is used, thought to be, through a predictive coding model. So you're actually not just, like, hanging out, taking in the world. You're constructing the world. You have a picture of the world in your head, and then anything that differs from that, you're going to notice. So this is like a kind of classic example of, you know, the one on the left, you know, looks convex, right? And the one on the right looks concave, and they're actually like the same images, just rotated. And it's because of this view we have of the world that we are always, you know, in interpreting that. And then this quote is actually William James, and he said this, like, you know, 100 years ago, and he's a pretty smart guy. So there's this thing called interoception, and so that's like the sensing of internal states. So you have the insular cortex. So all these nerves that are going from the gut, from the, you know, every organ, I'm saying gut, but, and also muscle, tendons, telling you where you are, vestibular, is telling you where you are in space. This is all going up to the CNS, up to the brain, and then being somehow mapped up in this thing called the insular cortex. And then that data is then being compared to, like, the data outside of you, and that's kind of, like, giving you a sense of what's going on, and any error in that helps you negotiate the world better. So I don't know if you've seen this, Alex has seen this already, but so owls have, like, really cool vestibular reflex whereby, you know, we're not thinking about this all the time. We're not like, oh, I've got a, you know, we have an ocular reflex. I mean, the guy is pretty scary, right? I mean, I don't know what's going on at the job. But anyway, we're not, this isn't conscious to us. But this isn't conscious, but we're doing it all the time. You know, the eye gaze, it's like, so this is a lot of computation going on. And so, you know, we're a wonder. We're a wonder. So, yeah, interoception is really important. And so the way we do that in the lab is to get people to self-report on how fast their heart is beating. And so if they can do that really well, then they're good at some other things. People who are depressed actually are really, really bad at that. People who have eating disorders are really bad at that. It's like, you know, you're losing that sense. You're losing that sense of, like, what is going on the inside. And so, yeah, this is what's happening about the predictive coding model. All these inputs are coming in from you from the outside, are coming in from you from the inside, and there's, again, like, I kind of visualize this sort of tension in the how you are on the inside. I mean, it sounds obvious when you say it, and I'm sure as artists, some of you know this. You know how your state is going to affect your perception, and vice versa. And so, I don't know if you know about the facial feedback hypothesis. So this is how, if you force, how, you know, your muscles in your face, like, convey emotion, but if you force yourself to experience those muscle sensation, that will then influence your emotion. Again, William James was a huge fan of just saying, like, emotion is this manifestation of physiological state. It's not like you feel the emotion and then you smile. It's like it's kind of one and the same. And so the ability to, like, kind of touch yourself and, like, go, hey, this is you, you know, this is me. That really helps you navigate in the world. There is a condition whereby you actually think, like, other body parts are yours. So, like, I could have, like, a really strong attachment to your leg right now and be like, that's totally my leg, and that's due to, like, cortical lesions. And I don't know if you know about this, like, rubber hand illusion. It's, like, quite a famous... You know about it? No? Yes? No? So, basically, you have... one arm is, like, out of sight, another arm is there. You can have the rubber hand there, and you will get, like, attacked, and your reflex, thinking that it's yours. And what I find really interesting is, even when you know it's not yours, you still think it is. So this top down, like, this logical control is not strong enough to trump that. And there was this test that I think is really interesting whereby, okay, the humans now playing a computer game whereby there's, like, this dot that's moving, and they have to, like, make it do a certain thing or counteract the moving. And they have the computer basically help them. So when they're screwing up, the computer will, like, ignore them screwing up and be like, you're still doing fine. So there's this illusion that every time you get it right, it's because of you. And it enhances the self sense of agency. And so the authors say, you know, if automation technology could improve task performance without you knowing, then it enhances the sense of agency, which makes me think that's what we are. I think we're probably screwing up, like, all the time, right? And we only register the times it works out. And your body is just like, no, 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 we got this, we got this. And, your brain is like, hey, I got this. And your body's got it, but it's like allowing your brain to think that it's got it. Maybe I kind of feel that this is maybe where this sense of agency comes from. And so, yeah, this is kind of the end, and I just want to... This is the test for despair. And you put the mouse in what's called a forced swim test. And when I first encountered this, I just thought this is kind of like a metaphor for life. The guys that give up really easily are meant to be like the depressed mice, because they're just like, oh. But I always think they're smarter because they know they're going to be pulled out the minute they give up. So I don't know. But as you watch this, I'm just going to read some of the main points of the essay that I want to get across, and you can just like contemplate these two things together. Oh, come on. So, sensing, learning, and memory are inherent to life. Vital properties occurring at all levels of an organism's existence. Every aspect of ourselves that we have been or will be, from the single cell to the integrated organism, from 5 seconds ago until now, exists by detecting and comparing self to non-self, predicted to observed, interior to exterior. Maps of our body and maps of the world are how we navigate. They are formed dynamically in the relationships between the microbial world and the immune system and the nervous system, extero and interoception. Processes occurring simultaneously in differentiated but communicating systems non-consciously inform our decision-making and our behaviour in such a way that internal stakes affect the way we interpret the world and vice versa. It is through this complex, simultaneous body-world mapping that we exist. The brain has taken precedence as the organ of perception, interpretation, learning, memory, emotion, decision-making, and initiation of actions, and neurons as the units of cognitive processing. By recognizing that these processes are an epiphenomena of life, belonging to all cells, we may come to view ourselves as not merely a reflection of brain activity, but as the ongoing product of states that are continuously in flux, in which numerous interconnected dynamic relationships exist at all scales, across all systems, not limited to a particular location. Self and sense not only exist in the neurons and extend well beyond the brain. That's it, guys. We can just, like, leave him there. flailing for another couple of minutes. Go ahead, and also I'll just be around. I tried to cover a lot, and I missed a lot out. But yeah, if you think you have a question that other people will be interested in.
What is it about science that you said you have a problem with?
I don't have a problem with it. I think I just went into it being very naive, you know, from as a kid, and now I see it for what it is.
Which is? What is that, what you see with that?
I see it as, well, for me, I really like getting paid to just look at life every day, but I see it now as just one way to look at things, which is usually like very like positive, you know, reinforcement. I mean, it's not, it's negative. I mean, it's 99% failure, and like I'm a complete masochist, but like if something fits, it kind of just perpetuates a way of thinking, which I think is kind of what's necessary for it to exist. Like, that's what I say, it's just mixed. There are good things, like that Alzheimer's thing is amazing, you know, our technique is probably really going to help people with Parkinson's. But to also reduce a mood or a state to, like, numbers of marbles buried, it's like a bit depressing.
What was that?
Like, if you're going to reduce, you know, a state or a mood of existence to counting the number of marbles that are buried, mm-hmm. you know, it's a bit depressing.
Yes, itself. That's what I think I meant.
And I didn't realise people don't know that. And I feel like compared to England, so many people here, or medication seems to be the answer. I think this is something that Thea and I maybe, you know, sympathise with each other about, that maybe it's not always the answer, or just people should be aware that that drug has maybe stopped that mouse like jumping up and down a million times, and but it might not be the thing for you. So, but I mean, I love science. Like I say, it's like my mum, but it's the best we've got. But I've just seen that. Because it's the people are looking for something, so they're ignoring the stuff they're not looking for. And things get trendy, the brain got really trendy. And this is just my way of self-flagellating. I couldn't give this talk at Rockefeller, right? I couldn't be like, guys, what are we doing?
Really?
No, I don't think so.
You would have a pure your problems with it?
No, but again, I mean, I'm sure there are again the parallels with the art world. Like, in science, it would be like, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing, it's the best thing, it's going to revolutionise the world, mm. employ me, pay me, mm. give me money to do more. Like, yeah. It's the best. Not like, oh, well, we might have got a bit wrong here, and, you know.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Hi.
Hey, I've got a question. I wanted to hear you talk a bit about how what you know about language on the neuron level. So, see what artists hear, language, music, pattern recognition, how, you know, the culture of mice, like you just described this one less dominant mouse, like what other things do mice recognize about each other when they see each other in the brain? How do we see that?
You're into the brain. You came to the wrong talk.
You're joking. Just, what I understood is you're talking about systems in general, right? And you're a neuroscientist, right? So yeah. I'm an artist, so I know about like aesthetics, you know. But you're talking about how that might reflect. You studied up close how you know the echo of that in the brain. If that, maybe
so,
you can talk about that.
Yeah, sure. So, in mice. We're not totally crazy. We're not going to impose completely how we interpret the world onto them. So they really into smell, right? The minute you put two mice together, they're checking each other out smell-wise, on a smell level. And that communicates a lot of what is going on, especially with maternal behaviour, mating behaviour, fighting, whatever. So on a very basic level, that's going to be recognised in the in the sensory cortex, which is a very well defined strip of neurons in the cortex.
And you're able to see the music of that, of how they're interacting with each other, and that their moods.
What do you mean?
You just said that they're going to there's going to be based on smell, for instance.
Mm.
Like, I remember someone talking to me about how dogs, because their sense of smell, they can sniff out the socks of their. I've never owned a dog, but apparently they're really into that, like smelling the feet of the owner, and so maybe their map of this room is very different from mine.
Oh, definitely,
right?
for sure. So I'm wondering
also, how does that reflect it? Okay, so that's the dog's map.
Yeah.
We are studying the brain of the human, of the dog, and we're very visual animals as human beings, and so we're looking at this cortex.
Consciously, you're very visual.
Right.
What you're paying attention to is very visual.
Yeah, I'm talking about that part. I'm talking about how we talk to each other about it, how we record the data about it, how we recognize. Is there a possibility of recognizing the language of the dog? Because of what's happening in the brain. Because of the music of that in the neural activity.
Yeah, I mean
the music
that,
of what's happening between these mice who are friends or not friends, as it's reflected in the brain.
Right now, I don't know if you know optogenetics, the next stage of that, this guy Carl Dieseros, he's at Stanford. We are now simultaneously like stimulating and recording. So along with this tiny optic fiber that you would put in the brain, we can't do this on dogs. I mean, we're not doing that. But on mice, like tiny optic fiber now with like a microscope on the end of it. So and these dyes, these that reflect calcium concentration. So that's a very crude reflection of nerve activity. That's like the first thing I showed you with the Cronenberg quote, right? So you could see that. You could see like, oh, there's a network happening there. But that temporal resolution is completely shit compared to what I do. I record currents. They're on like microsecond timescales. So that's one level of activity that you can see. But then it's still what you have to understand. It's not common amongst everyone. The way your brain, I mean, they're going to be crude differences, as in it's going to be in the visual cortex, but the way your brain represents orange is actually going to be very, very different to the way my brain represents orange because of that emergent thing I showed, because we are developing, and it's about all the inputs you've ever encountered before.
Let me ask you just a simple kind of philosophical question. Do I even really represent oranges? Do I think I represent oranges? Because when we're communicating, I mean, psychologists have noted that the way to achieve rapport with someone is to use their language. So there's this illusion that we're together, that we're connected, that we're feeling the same thing, when that might not be the case.
But if you're feeling it, why is it an illusion?
Well, we're talking, just now you talked about the fact that there was a real orange that was experienced over all this time. So I'm trying to ask you a question. Was there really an experience of an orange, or is there this eternal system that's saying that experience took place?
Because
your entire talk sort of suggests that there's not really any kind of, even these organisms aren't, these cells or whatever objects you've described, these systems aren't discrete systems, are constantly negotiating this separation and this involvement.
Mm.
Would that be the same of our relationship to any object that we perceive in our
system? Definitely. Everything you think about that object, it is taking into account like everything you've experienced that you might deem relevant or irrelevant. I don't know. I mean, that's certainly not my expertise. There are a lot of people who do fMRI who are interested in those types of questions, whether what are we perceiving? And I definitely think that we are perceiving a lot that we're not attending to. So we don't know we are, but it's there. So I don't think I can answer your questions with science.
Are we perceiving something, or are we acting like we're perceiving something?
I don't think that's a question for a neuroscientist. I think that's a question for a philosopher.
I have a comment, maybe it's a question. I think the thing that you had opened up with was this idea of like how the brain has become like this focus, and it's like the hip thing to do in science now. And I've thought about that a lot around the idea of the way we model the body now and the way we model behavior in our society. So think about it in terms of economics and historically. Like 200 years ago, the body was like a bunch of organs, and it was like organized like a clock or a machine, because that was like the Industrial Revolution, and that was like the economic model that we're organizing states and industry around. And so we looked at the body as a microcosm kind of expressing that. And today, like, we're in this, you know, sort of information economy where information is becoming the means of exchange and the place where value exists and is expressed. And so you have projects like the Brain Project, in where, which I guess this will be my question. I'd love to hear your perspective on it. When I've read about the Brain Project, I don't know if folks in the room are aware of what it is, and I don't know if I can explain it properly, but my understanding of it is that they're trying to use massive computing to create a simulacrum of an individual human brain with the projected idea of
I think, well, You're talking about Henry Markram's project.
Like essentially, I don't know his name, but
okay.
Reconstituting or constituting a human brain.
A cortical column.
Okay.
A human brain is massive. One cortical column.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think you could see where the direction is going. Yeah.
Yeah.
The direction is towards some form of autonomous artificial intelligence. So then the question becomes: if one were to able to achieve that at some point in the future, what would be the role of biology, gender, race? Human sensations, bodily functions. What would be, what would be the consequence or the biological consequence of something like that were to succeed?
Well, I think what my argument is that if that was the case, if the brain was a computer, I think we would have solved it by now. And what I'm saying is that it's you're never gonna not need biology until you take into account all of this, because that is part of it. Okay, you can model a circuit, and there are circuits in the brain, but we don't know if that's how like we're using it, and that we could like create all different types of artificial intelligence. But as I was saying, like, oh look, the immune system solves something differently now. We're going to use that. So I think what will happen is there'll be, like, progress until, like, a dead end is met. And then someone will be like, oh, God, there's this other really cool thing that life does. Let's use that and model that. And then they'll all come together. Yeah.
Where can we find the essay that you mentioned?
It's going to be published in a book in the fall. And I'll let Alex... No, I even, they were even thinking maybe they could, like, bring the book here or something. Or have it changed.
Right. It's an MIT Press book, yeah.
Yeah.
Does it have a title yet?
Yeah. It's a lot, it has a colon and lots of stuff. it's like, yeah.
Just Google Leah's name.
No. I mean, it'll have, like, an object and a scent and things. It's going to be a thing, but... When's it at? We'll put it on the website or something. But also, read Mind and Life. He basically says it a way lot better than I could ever say it. I mean,
Sorry, I'm back. Was wondering if you could kind of break down some of the words you used.
Yeah, sure.
Like, so sometimes you use the word cognition, sometimes you say intelligence, and then agency, I guess, is sort of in there. If you have a model of thinking that's sort of distributed, right, which is what I think you're kind of proposing here, then what happens to that, to agency in that model? And I would just kind of, and I'm just thinking about this sort of politically, right, so because the Enlightenment model of thinking is that, like, because we can make decisions, then we can do politics, right, and we can make, you know, basically all of our philosophy is sort of built around that. So if you have a distributed model of intelligence, what happens to individual agency and politics? You know what I mean?
Well, I guess I was thinking that if a computer can, so I would say agency is like the sense that you are causing something to happen, and if a computer can like trick you into that, then I don't know kind of how valuable that is, or I mean I don't know what you mean how you to extrapolate that politically. I think it's just it's like a bias. It's like a bias to allow you to kind of get on with stuff. But you could probably think for me. Like, I think you could probably answer it better. I haven't thought it through that much, what it would mean politically. I just think that we're not going to figure out how we work just by looking at the brain. That's kind of my point. And cognition, I would say, is a way in psychology, you know, it's just using data to make a decision. That's the way I think about it. But tell me, what do you think?
That was an honest question. It's a question I've thought about before, but it just seems, I always kind of come around to it. You know, because I totally agree with you. I mean, I think evolution is a kind of problem solving, right? I mean, that's sort of obvious. So, but on the other hand, we all have to like elect a president in like a year. So, you know, I would like to think I was making that decision. It wasn't because of the yogurt I ate. So
yogurt you ate, but it's probably maybe because of like all the people around you and where you are in
right.
the world.
True, yeah. No, it's the same. Yeah.
It's the same. I'm not speaking like this. I know so much about this. It's like this is just what I think, and it's not something I could say at a lab meeting. You know, I'd have to be like, bar chart-tastic. thanks.
Who's the author of Mind and Life?
Evan Thompson.
Evan Thompson.
I think so, yeah. This was just at a party. I was like talking about my ideas and someone said, that's called an activism. And there's a big, but like, that is a thing. So I didn't know that. So yeah, I don't wanna. Yeah, Evan Thompson. Thanks,
Thank you.
Guys. Thanks.